Support for the World's Podcast and the following message come from LegalZoom. Nearly 2 million Americans have used LegalZoom to start their businesses, with LLCs, incorporation, and more. But even after your business is set up, LegalZoom can still help you out. Things like lease agreements, changing tax laws, and contract reviews are all part of running your own business. And these are precisely the kinds of costly hurdles that can take time away from growing your business. That's why LegalZoom created their business legal plan. Check out LegalZoom's business legal plan at LegalZoom.com now and get special savings when you enter the word world at checkout. LegalZoom, where life meets legal. LegalZoom.com.
Hey there, listener. You're going to want to hear this. When you set up a recurring donation of $10 a month or more before April 28th, you'll be entered to hear your name on the show. That's right, your name right here on The World. Visit theworld.org/gift to learn more and donate. The Putin and Kim Show, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The leaders of two big American adversaries meet for the first time, but one Russian observer in Seoul says not to worry.
The major player is Donald Trump, not Vladimir Putin, and probably not even Xi Jinping, because major decisions are made now in Washington, and it's a fact of life.
Also today, climate change forces El Salvador's farmers to find new crops.
Even if you have the money to change to a new variety, you're going to have to wait 4 or 5 years because the new plants are going to have to grow.
And a group of counter-cyber spies ratchet up the pressure on Iran.
The secrets of this group, they really seem to have hacked the hackers.
Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. A military band welcomed a smiling Kim Jong-un in Vladivostok, Russia today, as North Korea's leader stepped off his train. It's Kim's first visit to Russia, a country he's long dreamed of seeing, he said today. The North Korean leader also told a reporter for Russian state TV that he's looking forward to a successful visit. Kim's summit with President Vladimir Putin is scheduled for tomorrow, and Andrei Lankov is watching it all closely. He's Russian, who studies North Korea from his base at Seoul's Kukmin University. To begin, I asked him why Putin is sitting down with Kim.
Essentially to remind the entire world that Russia exists, that it has some interests and possibly some influence in regard to the North Korean issues. Because over the last 2 years, Russia has been pushed aside and did not play any significant role in the complicated negotiations around North Korea and North Korean nuclear issue. So the major message is just, I would say, a polite reminder that Russia should not be completely forgotten when it comes to the Korean issues.
So, mostly a photo op, but you did mention, Andrei Lankov, that Russia has some interests in North Korea. What are they?
In a nutshell, Russia's interest in North Korea is about stability. Russia doesn't want to deal with a serious crisis on the Far East. Not because Russia is such a peace-loving country, but because such a crisis is not going to be good for its national interests. It's going to be expensive and difficult to manage.
They share the border. Are you saying that Russia
yeah.
is concerned that maybe refugees
yes.
would come over the border into Russia?
And not only refugees, all kind of nasty stuff. So they want basically the area to be stable and they want status quo. And in theory, Russia would like to see denuclearization. However, over the last 10 or 15 years, it has become a near consensus among the Russian decision makers and analysts and scholars that North Korea is not going to surrender its nuclear weapons.
When it comes to the nuclear issue, everybody seems to know that the real players in the negotiations are the presidents of the U.S. and China. They're the real powers. And
yes.
yet we also know that the U.S. aim of getting North Korea to denuclearize is not going well. What could Kim be telegraphing about that process with this visit to Putin?
Kim will pay lip service to his alleged desire to surrender nuclear weapons. And this lip service should not be taken too seriously.
Mm.
And then, after all necessary declarations, he will probably introduce some ideas about a possible compromise. North Koreans are not going to surrender their nuclear weapons. They saw what happened to Muammar Gaddafi of Libya, who is the only strongman in recent history who surrendered nuclear weapons. They remember that Ukraine once received guarantee of its borders from Russia, of all countries, United States and UK in exchange for nuclear weapons. And then you know what happened to Crimea. Therefore, they believe in weapons, not going to surrender it. But they are probably willing to negotiate some kind of freeze or even reduction of their nuclear potential in exchange for sanctions being lifted and maybe some additional assistance, some additional investment provided. And it's probably going to be discussed. However, as you have said, the major player is Donald Trump, not Vladimir Putin, and probably not even Xi Jinping, because major decisions are made now in Washington, and it's, well, fact of life.
Historically, as you well know, it's not uncommon for North Korea to play off the larger powers against each other. Is that what Kim is doing?
It's what the entire Kim family has been doing with great brilliance for 70 years. They are great diplomats. Maybe Kim Jong-un is not as good as his father and grandfather, but it's a part of the family tradition. They used to play Russians against Chinese, then South Koreans against Americans, and Chinese against Americans. And, well, it's how they basically run diplomacy.
Andrei Lankov, a North Korea expert at Seoul's Kukmin University. Let's turn now to news out of the United Nations. Yesterday, the UN Security Council passed a resolution condemning sexual violence in war. Should not have been a controversial vote, but the resolution was only approved after language referring to sexual and reproductive health was taken out. The U.S. delegation had threatened to veto the measure, in line with the Trump administration's opposition to any official document that even implies support for abortion. Amanda Klassing co-directs the Women's Rights Division at Human Rights Watch.
Rape as a weapon of war is something that has been documented over the last few decades, but is certainly pervasive. It's when the parties to a conflict have used sexual violence to instill terror, to really try to break social fabrics and try to humiliate and harm civilian populations. You see this when women are fleeing from conflict. You may see it when military try to occupy a community. We also have seen the knock-on effects of this type of violence can last decades.
How did this resolution, at least in the eyes of the White House, Amanda, imply support for abortion?
Surprisingly, they have just read into every mention of sexual and reproductive health and rights the idea of abortion. When we talk about sexual and reproductive health and rights, particularly for victims of sexual violence, what we're talking about is the broad range of services that are needed for somebody who's been raped. That includes access to emergency contraception, prophylaxis so that they don't have sexually transmitted infections. And in some cases, that might mean access to abortion or prenatal care if they choose to continue a pregnancy.
I mean, they ultimately signed the resolution. How watered down was the language?
They actually removed all language related to reproductive health and also removed a paragraph that refers to an earlier UN Security Council resolution that talks about sexual and reproductive health and rights.
So what does the resolution actually say now, and practically what does that mean on the ground for women who end up in that horrific situation?
So the resolution looks at a broad range of issues, including accountability for acts of sexual violence and conflict. In practice, the resolutions that previously exist still hold true. But what it means is that governments won't feel as compelled to make commitments to ensure that all range of services are available to victims of sexual violence and conflict.
So the original resolution was submitted by Germany. How did they react to the change and other countries that wanted to have the original language?
Germany was in a really difficult position. With the U.S. actually flexing its veto, they had to choose whether or not to remove this language or to see the whole resolution die, essentially. And so they conceded to this language. It certainly is a step back from global consensus around what it is women who have been raped in war deserve to access after they've had such a terrible thing happen.
Why did Russia and China abstain from this vote?
They abstained from the vote related to some other issues within the resolution. China was concerned about language about women human rights defenders, and Russia did not agree to language regarding LGBT rights.
So how much weight does this resolution actually carry? Is it another non-binding symbolic statement from the UN, or do you think there are real teeth in this?
I think the biggest concern here is that we have seen over the last couple of years a broad global attack on women's rights. And the UN has really been a challenging place to reassert global consensus on women's rights. So it's reflective of the power that the Trump administration has to really influence backtracking on women's rights. And you see, it's not just in conflict, but as we see rising authoritarianism, rising populism, it's often the women's rights activists that are kind of on the front line of being attacked. When we have countries like the United States allying with other countries like Russia and Saudi Arabia to try to roll back women's rights, it really puts women on the front lines at risk and leaves them alone.
Amanda Klassing with Human Rights Watch, speaking with us from Washington. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hacking the Hackers. Since 2014, members of a prolific Iranian hacking group have hit both private and state targets. Now they're getting a taste of their own medicine. Andy Greenberg is a reporter with Wired. Tell us what we know about this Iranian hacker group, Oil Rig, also known as APT-34.
Well, Oil Rig is really one of the most active cyber espionage hacking groups in the world. They seem to be working on behalf of the Iranian government, and their targets have included the oil industry and other parts of the private sector, everywhere from Qatar to Israel, and many of these governments as well. Some of the infrastructure of the hackers seems to have been based in Iran in earlier years, and now we can kind of tie together this whole set of intrusions by code similarities between all of these attacks. So it looks like it's all one group.
Yeah, and then onto the scene arrives this mysterious other group. What have they said about exposing Oil Rig secrets?
Just last month, this group appeared in a public channel on the messaging service Telegram. They called themselves Lab Dukhtegan, which I think translates from Farsi to those who have their lips sewn shut. And they are spilling the secrets of this group. They really seem to have either hacked the hackers, or they may be composed of an insider from the group and is doing this to disrupt their operations, embarrass them, even put them in danger.
So what kind of messages have you been seeing in the public Telegram channel for Lab Dukhtegan?
Well, this group has posted lots of sort of rhetorical messages alluding to the corruption and the damage done to Iranian society by its Ministry of Intelligence. But it also has really got the goods. They have posted all of the hacking tools of this group. I mean, these are tools used to maintain a connection inside of a hacking victim, for instance. Even more dramatically, they're posting photos and identities, social media screenshots of the Iranians that are allegedly within this group.
Is it too early, Andy, to try and understand what their motivations are?
There is an apparent motivation, which is some sort of righteous Iranian insider who is calling out, you know, what they say is the corruption of this intelligence agency from within. But all of the comments that I'm getting on my story about this and on Twitter points out that they don't actually seem to be native Farsi speakers. They certainly want to look like they're Iranians. Instead, this appears to be some other nationality of pretending to be Iranian. Then there's also the possibility that this is an external intelligence agency. It may be a message to Oil Rig that they've stepped across too many lines, that they're simply too aggressive.
You've drawn comparisons between this group, Lab Dukhtegan, and the shadow brokers hack of the NSA. Explain that. Remind us what that was about.
Well, the shadow brokers is this remarkable and still entirely unsolved mystery that unfolded starting in the summer of 2016. These mysterious hackers who call themselves the shadow brokers started leaking the hacking tools of the NSA, which is such a remarkable event because we had never seen anything like this collection of tools. This was probably a more significant leak from the NSA than even Edward Snowden's leaks.
Wow.
This group of hackers would just appear periodically to taunt the NSA, publish more of their tools, occasionally even out former NSA hackers. It's very similar to what's happening here, and it kind of seems like this shadow broker's technique is being used to disrupt and embarrass and stymie another state-sponsored hacking group. You could come up with a theory that perhaps Lab Dukhtegan is NSA and that they're doing to the Iranians what was done to them, but you know, there's really no evidence of that yet, and it doesn't honestly strike me as the kind of thing the NSA does. The NSA is usually a lot quieter.
So how big a blow is Lab Dukhtegan to Oil Rig, and what does this tell us about Iranian state hacking?
I think it's a setback. All of their tools are essentially burned. Now we have them all identified. If they're used again, it's very clear who used them, and they're easier to detect. So they probably have to start over and develop a lot of their tools again. But it's not that hard to rebuild tools that are not as recognizable. So it's a message sent to this group, and it certainly will cost them something. But I think we'll see them just as active in a few months or a year.
Andy Greenberg with Wired Magazine. Thanks very much for your time, Andy.
Thank you, Marco.
Up next, climate change and coffee beans. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Over the years, a lot of El Salvadorans have left their country and headed north. Nearly 20% of Salvadoran citizens now live in the U.S., almost 1.5 million people. A lot of factors contribute to that migration: gang violence, a stagnant economy. Here's another: climate change. It's had a big impact on the country's once dominant coffee industry. Here's more from reporter Emily Green.
At the San Isidro coffee farm outside San Salvador, Yolanda del Carmen Marin waters a field of baby coffee plants. She's worked here since she was 12, and she's done just about every job there is.
Cortando, peinando,
cutting the plants, watering them, picking out the substandard seeds. The coffee plants used to be big, she says. Each one would produce 3 baskets of beans. Now, she says, they hardly produce anything. The harvest, it's disappearing little by little. And so is the workforce. Del Carmen says there used to be up to 10 workers dedicated just to watering the plants. Now, they're just 2. It's the same across pretty much all the jobs on the farm. And this coffee farm is a microcosm of what's happening across El Salvador. Coffee production here is half of what it was 10 years ago. And during that time, the industry has lost more than 80,000 jobs.
Oscar René Reyes Turcio, ese es mi nombre.
Oscar René Turcio has also seen this decline firsthand. He says he's been working on this farm for 45 years. This farm used to employ a lot of people, he says, because it produced so much coffee, around 4,000 tons a year back in the 70s. This year, it's producing only around 300. There are a lot of reasons for the decline, but things got really bad in the last 10 years. Turcio says the main culprit is a disease known as La Roya. It's a fungus that decimated coffee harvest across Central America in 2012 and 13, and it's still a big problem. The Roya epidemic left the plants weak, Turcio says, and climate change only made things worse. He says sometimes the rains come early and the coffee plants begin to flower, but then the rains stop and the plants dry up. Sometimes, he says, the rainy season arrives late, or not at all. This erratic weather can take a big toll.
Climate change, rising temperatures, longer dry periods, makes trees weaker and therefore more susceptible to diseases.
Paul Hicks is a coffee specialist with Catholic Relief Services in El Salvador. He says climate change is compounding the challenges for coffee farmers at a critical moment. Coffee was once the backbone of the country's economy.
In past decades, you had hundreds of thousands of people working on coffee farms. Because of the low production and low investment in coffee, a lot of those farm workers are choosing to migrate rather than to work on the coffee farms.
The question of investment is also key. Experts say there are ways to deal with the impacts of climate change and disease on coffee, like better irrigation systems and planting new, more pest-resistant varieties.
The problem is that it requires money, and many of these farmers are already hurting for money.
Edwin Castellanos is dean of research at Universidad del Valle in Guatemala, a country that's facing similar challenges.
The central governments are working on this, but they don't have enough resources to do this. And even if you have the money to change to a new variety, you're going to have to wait 4 or 5 years without having any harvest.
Castellanos says hundreds of thousands of Central American farmers have lost all or part of their crops due to droughts over the last 5 years. And the World Bank estimates that climate change could displace somewhere between 1.5 million to nearly 4 million people in Central America and Mexico over the next 30 years. No one knows how much that will add to the flow of migrants toward the U.S., but climate-related trouble in El Salvador's coffee industry is already adding to the migrant pressure in the region.
Aquí no hay trabajo.
There's no work here, says Yolanda del Carmen on the San Isidro coffee farm. And the prospects often aren't much better elsewhere. Del Carmen says that after leaving the farm a few years ago to study, her daughter could only find work selling pupusas, or corn pancakes. and that last fall, she joined that big migrant caravan headed to the U.S. Del Carmen's co-worker, Reina de Jesus Lopez, wishes she could join one of those caravans. She makes around $30 a week sifting through sacks of coffee for substandard beans. Hardly enough to get by. But, she says, she did send her 12-year-old son to the U.S. to live with a relative. Sometimes he tells me he wants to come back, she says. But she tells him, what are you going to do here? There are no opportunities for young people. For the world, Emily Green, Sonsonate, El Salvador.
The climate change protests that began in the UK last October are still going strong. In fact, there are way more people involved now than when they first started. Monday, Earth Day, more than 1,000 protesters were arrested in London alone, and the demonstrations have spread to other cities. The protesters go by the name Extinction Rebellion. Sarah Lunnan is part of Extinction Rebellion, has been taking part in the protests in London the last few days. What are your tactics? Describe them.
So our tactics are based on mass civil disobedience, non-violent direct action, and we basically aim to disrupt the economy and the activity going on around us. And on April the 15th, we occupied 5 sites in London, major traffic intersections, and actually stopped the traffic flowing through those areas, causing severe disruption across London.
I read that the rather progressive mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, I saw once the streets back to normal. I mean, so how long does this go on for?
Sadiq Khan issued a press release about Extinction Rebellion where he called for a return to business as usual. And basically that's our point. We can no longer return to business as usual. If we do, we do not have a future. And it's the recognition of that urgency, which has led to over 1,000, it's probably closer to 1,100 people now because people have been arrested as I speak. It's led to those people saying, I am so desperate. This is such an emergency. I am prepared to be arrested to make my point.
Despite the annoyance of blocked streets, this movement has really taken off in a way we have rarely seen in climate protests or any other kind of protest. Why do you think that is?
Because it gives an outlet to that huge amount of fear and anxiety that so many normal people have been feeling but have been unable to express. There hasn't been a framework for us to engage with climate change. And what Extinction Rebellion has done is allowed a voice for those people. And more importantly, has said, we need you to make this change in our government. And so it's allowed them a way in to take immediate and effective action.
Sarah, do you think your tactics and the civil disobedience and what some people are calling eco-terrorism, do you think it's achieving your goals? Is it working?
So I don't know if it's going to work. It may all be too late. It really might be too late for us. But there's nobody else with a better plan out there. It allows me to look at my children and say to them, I am doing the best I can for you.
Sarah Lunnan is part of Extinction Rebellion. She's been taking part in the protests in London over the past few days. Before we get back to the show, a quick reminder about our spring fundraiser. Contributions from listeners like you make our work possible. And when you set up a monthly recurring donation of $10 or more to The World before April 28th, you'll be entered to hear your name on the show as a thank you from all of us here at The World Newsroom. Visit theworld.org/gift to learn more and donate. And thank you very much. I'm Marco Werman. Some families seeking asylum at the border end up at detention centers like the one near Dilley, Texas. Conditions there can be tough.
One of the challenges when helping families is the children with them. They're often too sick to go to daycare or too traumatized to be separated from their moms.
That story's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. There's been a steep rise recently in the number of families arriving at the U.S.-Mexico border to seek asylum. And when they do, it's hard to predict what happens next. Some are released in the U.S. to wait for a court hearing. Others are told to wait in Mexico. Then there are families who are kept in jail-like facilities as their immigration cases are determined. Activists have raised questions about the conditions migrants face in detention. Reporter Julie Small takes us to rural Texas, to the town of Dilley, home to the largest detention facility for immigrant families in the country.
The official name of the place is the South Texas Family Detention Center. A lot of people just call it Dilley for the town nearby. The facility is surrounded by plains and brush, and it can hold up to 2,400 mothers and their children. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, refused my request for a tour of the detention center. So Katie Mirdza, an advocate with the Dilley Pro Bono Project who's helping families there, drove me to see it from the outside.
Driving over the cattle guard.
Mirdza says there's not much for lawyers and volunteers like her to do around here at night.
There's two bars. There's a statue of a watermelon because Dilley used to be known for watermelon. And there's some taco stands. That's pretty much it.
Then her car startles a creature that bounds off into the brush.
It could be a deer. Yeah, there's deer out here. There's coyotes. There's armadillos.
From a distance, you can see large tents for processing the families. There are also big light posts. Mirdza says at night, the detention center's floodlights are so bright, there's a glow a mile away. Core Civic, the private prison company that runs Dilley, has warned Mirdza not to do interviews anywhere near, so we drive down the highway and park. Mirdza says volunteers have to go through a rigorous security check each time they enter detention. To speed things up, they use plastic see-through backpacks.
There's a lot of things you can't bring in. You can't bring in makeup, hand sanitizer, anything that ICE considers contraband.
Once inside, attorneys can only access meeting rooms or a type of courtroom where families present their cases to a judge via satellite TV. Mirdza says that one of the challenges when helping families is the children with them. They're often too sick to go to daycare or too traumatized to be separated from their moms. So the moms bring the kids along to legal consultations.
We've had kids, you know, throwing up in the meeting with the mom, and moms are deciding between going and waiting for hours at the clinic or meeting with their lawyer when they have...
Part of Mirdza's day is spent filing email complaints to ICE on behalf of clients she says aren't receiving the care they need, like mothers with pregnancy complications or children losing weight quickly. In an email response, ICE stated that the allegations were being made by, quote, non-clinicians with very limited access and knowledge to the full range of services and care provided, end quote. ICE also added that migrants at Dilley who require a higher level of care are referred to the local hospital network. But not everyone agrees the care is adequate for detained families. Dr. Scott Allen was contracted by Homeland Security to investigate the quality of medical care in family detention.
The government had great difficulty in keeping children safe and meeting their own standards. Our concern is that if you rapidly expand that, the logistical challenges are multiplied and the number of children placed at risk is also increased.
Allen says it's not the fault of dedicated staff. It's problems with recruiting and retaining qualified pediatricians and mental health care providers. It's the remote locations that make it difficult to access emergency care.
That has been continuous across facilities and continued until our last investigation.
Now Dr. Allen is blowing the whistle and publicly saying that any expansion of family detention would increase the risks to detained children. The Trump administration's also trying to dismantle a long-standing agreement that sets standards for keeping migrant children in custody.
You can detain children, but if you detain children, you've got to meet certain requirements.
Bill Hing is a professor at the University of San Francisco who helps monitor facilities holding kids. He says a place like Dilley can only be used temporarily for holding children with their parents. Hing says the Trump administration is trying to get around that by arguing that the standards should only apply to children who arrive to the U.S. without a parent. Hing says that's missing the point.
You know, even if you got your mom with you, you're still a child.
Hing says the family detention center in Dilley does have classrooms, a library, and places to exercise. But when he visited, he saw something else.
20, 30 women sitting there with their kids, and some infants, and some 5 or 6 years old. Most of them, this is where it's sad, lethargic, not with any energy, or the nose is running, coughing, and that kind of thing. And that's when you do say to yourself, really, in the United States, we have this?
Right now, immigration officials are detaining about 600 parents and kids together.
there's room for more. In Dili, Katie Mirza says no families have to be locked up.
ICE can choose whether or not to detain someone, and that's why we are advocating for the end to family detention. It's not something that's required.
But with thousands of families coming to the border every week, more could end up in detention. The government recently announced it will spend $40 million to build two tent cities for migrant families in Texas. For The World, Julie Small, Dili, Texas.
Julie's story was reported in collaboration with KQED. President Trump says the U.S. can't take any more immigrants. He made that clear earlier this month during a visit to the border in California.
Our country is full. Our area is full. The sector is full. Can't take you anymore. I'm sorry. Can't happen. So turn around. That's the way it is.
But that's not what many states are saying. Several are struggling to attract workers, including Vermont, a place that's emptying with a declining aging population and falling birth rates. So Vermont's racing to bring in new residents. And as The World's Rupa Shenoy reports, the Green Mountain State is trying to figure out a way to be more welcoming.
40 years ago, Curtis Reed came to Vermont for a ski vacation and got stuck in a storm. He had to sleep in a Dunkin' Donuts for 2 nights before he could make it to a friend's house. That gave him plenty of time to take in Vermont's natural beauty.
Spent 3 weeks skiing, eating, drinking, and decided this was paradise. 6 months later, I moved here.
It was a good fit. Reed loves skiing, camping, and being outdoors.
I wanted to be in Vermont before I even knew Vermont existed.
But since moving here, Reed's seen downtown stores close in towns across the state. Taxes have gone up. Wages for many have stagnated. Reed, a diversity consultant who works with the state, says improving the economy means bringing in more people. But Vermont has only tried to attract one kind of new resident.
You know, Vermont's marketing strategy for decades was white heterosexual males with family incomes of $120,000 or more. That population is shrinking.
So Vermont has two problems. It doesn't have enough people to do the jobs it already has. And it doesn't know how to attract people who aren't like Vermont's current population, which is overwhelmingly white. Meanwhile, the situation is getting worse. Under the Trump administration's policies, there are fewer refugees, immigrants, even temporary visa workers coming into the state. Joan Goldstein, commissioner of the Vermont Department of Economic Development, says the race is on. States are competing to attract new residents.
That sounds very mercenary, but we're in a competitive marketplace.
She says Vermont's made a huge change. Instead of trying to attract businesses to the state, they're appealing directly to individuals.
Other states have asked us how we did this, so even though it's a departure, it's probably going to be more mainstream soon.
This year, Vermont began handing out $10,000 for certain workers who moved to the state.
Close to 25% of people coming in with inquiries were from other countries.
But so far, none of the 26 people approved for the $10,000 grant have been refugees or people who moved from another country. That may be because there are barriers for immigrants who want to work in the state. Chris Winters, the Deputy Secretary of State, says it's been unnecessarily difficult for people to get their credentials from elsewhere to count in Vermont.
When you go beyond protecting the public, you start unfairly keeping people out of professions who are otherwise qualified to be there.
So this month, the Vermont legislature passed, and the governor's expected to sign, a bill that would make it easier for many immigrants to transfer their qualifications so they can get certified for jobs in the state. The state's also making other moves, like hiring a chief racial equity and diversity officer. Winters hopes that'll help attract, among others, nearby Canada's many new diverse immigrants to work in Vermont. He says diversity is key to keeping millennials in the state, and he points to his own daughter, who's leaving Vermont for college because she doesn't feel like she's met different kinds of people.
I think it's really unfortunate that we've heard statements recently like, America is full, you know, there's no more room at the inn. I can tell you there's plenty of room in Vermont. We'd welcome immigrant professionals to help enhance our workforce, to fill our schools.
But Marita Canedo says Vermont still has a long way to go to appear welcoming to immigrants and people of color. Canedo is with the group Migrant Justice in Burlington.
If you're going to promote a state as the Green Mountain, beautiful landscape, you have to take into account the people that are there already and are struggling, which is the dairy industry.
Those people who work in Vermont's important dairy industry, many are undocumented.
Sobre antes en los ranchos no tenía un día de descanso.
Cruz Alberto Sanchez Perez came to Vermont from Mexico in 2015 to join two of his brothers working on dairy farms. He says they were paid less than minimum wage and didn't get a day off until they organized to demand better wages and benefits.
Todos en solidaridad porque la ayuda es para todos.
Sanchez Perez says it's still a tense, uncomfortable environment for people who look like him, even though he's just won asylum in the U.S.
Siempre el miedo.
In addition to immigration and customs enforcement, U.S. Border Patrol is on alert for undocumented people trying to cross into Canada. They have jurisdiction 100 miles from the federal border, which is a lot of Vermont.
Ahora yo creo que hay más sobre Border Patrol, sobre ICE, y siempre pues atacan más.
Vermont's also had some notable race incidents. This is state consultant Curtis Reed again with the Vermont Partnership for Fairness and Diversity.
Over the last 3 or 4 years, we've had a number of unfortunate incidents, like with Kaya.
He means Kaya Morris, who was Vermont's only female African-American state senator until she resigned last year because her family was being threatened and harassed.
With Rutland.
In the city of Rutland in 2017, an incumbent mayor campaigned on bringing in Syrian refugees to reinvigorate the local economy. The pushback he faced drew national attention, and he lost in what was seen at the time as a referendum on refugee resettlement.
Stowe.
Last year in Stowe, racial slurs were yelled at counselors and kids of color at a camp.
There are any number of places around the state that have had these incidents. And in the absence of a robust response, what's left in people's minds is, Vermont, I'll believe the SNL skit.
If they're going to keep coming here, then we're going to go someplace else. Our own place, for our own people.
Yeah.
No immigrants, no minorities. An agrarian community where everyone lives in harmony because every single person is white. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I know that place. That sounds like Vermont.
To dispel that image of Vermont, Reed says the state and local governments have to actively campaign against it by appealing specifically to immigrants and communities of color because they might not get their information the same way as white people. Vermont could advertise through social media like Black Twitter. It could advertise in Spanish.
It starts with an invite. And if you're inviting only to a shrinking population, then the net result of that is that your economic growth and prosperity is in jeopardy.
Reed says the natural beauty that drew him to Vermont isn't enough to sustain its economy. The state also has to embrace change. For the World, Rupa Shenoy, Burlington, Vermont.
There's big news from the world of Franz Kafka for those of you into despair and existential dread. Swiss safe deposit boxes filled with Kafka's unpublished manuscripts and letters will finally be opened, and the contents will get shipped to Israel. It brings to an end a decades-long legal battle over his literary estate. Benjamin Balint wrote about this legal drama in his book, Kafka's Last Trial. Balint told the CBC program As It Happens that right before Kafka died in 1924, he gave his personal papers to his best friend, Max Brod, and told Brod to burn everything. Luckily, Brod didn't listen.
Max Brod rescued the works of Franz Kafka more than once. He rescued them from Kafka's last will, as we said. He also rescued them in March of 1939 when Prague was just being occupied by the German forces. Max Brod took the last train out of Prague and carried with him a single suitcase. And in that suitcase, he had stuffed the manuscripts and drafts of Franz Kafka. And he brought that suitcase with him to his new life in Tel Aviv.
Brod didn't have children, so he left everything to his longtime secretary, Esther Hoffa, with instructions to donate Kafka's writings to a library or public institution in Israel. Instead, Hoffa sold pieces of the portfolio and stashed the rest in bank vaults and in her apartment, which was, by all accounts, disgusting.
I spoke to two members of the team who, in mid-September of last year, finally got access to that apartment, and they described cockroaches, spider webs, untended cats. Some of the manuscripts were, for example, just to give you a visual picture, were stored in an unplugged refrigerator. These were the conditions of Franz Kafka's manuscripts.
Years ago, Israeli courts ruled that the Hoffa family had to give up the manuscripts. But thanks to legal and bureaucratic complications worthy of a Kafka novel, it's only now that Israel's National Library finally has permission to access all of the documents. The trove probably contains letters and maybe, just maybe, endings to Kafka's unfinished works? That'd be something. We'll find out next month when the documents actually get to Israel. Shakila Zarin is just 23, but she's endured more than most people have in her two-plus decades. In 2012, the Afghan woman was shot in the face by the husband she was forced to marry. She survived and eventually resettled in Canada after the United States turned her away. The CBC's Laura Lynch has been following Shakila's transition to her new life in Vancouver.
In a few minutes, Shakila Zarin will be wheeled into an operating room to rebuild her face. She's lying on a gurney, surrounded by her mother and younger sister. They all begin to cry. Shakila is telling them to stay strong if something happens to her, and that she'll always be with them. Her mother responds by saying, "You're safe from now on. You've left those days behind." Those days were in 2012, when her husband entered her mother's house with a shotgun and aimed it at her face. Earlier that day, Shakila had reported him to the police for repeated abuse and rape. Her mother, Sharman John, was in another room when she heard a loud noise and screaming. Sharman John says, "I ran and saw Shakila lying down. I thought she was asleep. I turned her over and I said to myself, 'Oh my God, there was so much blood. I thought she was dead. I tried to lift her up and I pressed her against me and I thought, my God, they killed her. They killed Shakila.'" Sharman John managed to get Shakila into a taxi for an hours-long ride to a Kabul hospital where Shakila went into a coma. Her mother left her bedside to seek justice for her daughter, finally going to the gates of the presidential palace to demand action. An aide told her there was nothing they could do. This kind of violence happens to women in Afghanistan every day. Nobody cares about Afghan women's rights. They are ground into the dirt and trampled by powerful men. In fact, a UN report states that 80% of women face some form of violence and 60% experience multiple attacks in Afghanistan. After Shakila stabilized, she, her mother, and sister went to India in an arrangement brokered by the government there and senior officials in Kabul. She was given free medical treatment. They ended up staying in Delhi for 5 years. But even India wasn't far enough away. Her husband still threatened to kill her. They were certified as refugees, and the U.S. offered to take them in. Then Donald Trump came to office, and the offer was rescinded. The U.S. government sent Shakila a letter saying she was considered a security risk because of her husband's ties to the Taliban. That's when Canada stepped in and moved to bring them to Vancouver at the end of January of 2018.
Hi.
Hi.
Good morning, sir. How are you? I'm Dale.
Hi. I'm Shakila.
Within weeks, Shakila had her first appointment with one of Vancouver's top facial reconstruction surgeons, Kevin Bush. Though she speaks some English, she brought along an interpreter. At one point, when she asked the doctor a key question, the interpreter lost his composure.
Will I get my face back?
Yeah, you know, I think we can do some things to make things better for you, okay? The honest answer is that we can't get you right back to where you were before, okay?
A tear slid down Shakila's cheek as the doctor tried to explain. The shooting had destroyed the left side of her face. She lost her eye, her cheekbone and jaw were shattered. It would be a grueling process to rebuild. The surgery would still be months away. In the interim, she began building a new life.
Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday.
Shakila's deep bond with her mother is obvious as they practice their English. They both go for lessons at a newcomer's center, often holding hands as they ride the bus.
Her life has been a roller coaster in Vancouver, for sure. She's very, very strong.
Shakila also gets help from a young Afghan immigrant named Friba Rezaei. She reached out to the family after they arrived in Vancouver. Friba says it was clear from the first time they met
that Shakila is still dealing with the trauma.
We were at the cashier. We were standing by the line waiting for our coffee. There was an angry man. Maybe he didn't have a good day or something. She saw him and she got so scared. She started shaking and I held her hand and I hugged her. I said, it's okay. It's going to be okay. So I could see the trauma.
But there have also been many happy moments. Shakila is dancing with other women at a graduation ceremony. They've just finished a course to become counselors for other immigrant women who need support navigating their new country. She's smiling, surrounded by new friends. This kind of training has also propelled her to the national stage, where she's become an advocate to end violence against women. She spoke to a conference in the capital, Ottawa, last June.
Do not be silent in the face of violence. It is up to you to fight, and you can. I'm proud of all the women. We are the superwoman. I would never be quiet. Thank you so much.
From there, it was on to Canada's Parliament, where Shakila made her case for more support for refugees. Heady moments for a young woman born in a rural Afghan village who was pulled out of school in grade 7. Back in Vancouver, doctors were busy preparing for her surgery. At his office, Dr. Bush used a 3D model of Shakila's skull to explain the treatment plan.
There are these bone fragments that are still in there that are covered up. We're going to try and find those.
Right, so these are other actual pieces of her skull that have been displaced.
Yeah, these are pieces of her cheek that have been just shattered and pushed into this position.
Using bone from her leg, the team will rebuild her eye socket and shattered cheekbone, which means she can have a prosthetic eye that actually fits.
Her eye hangs down so much that she says she can't. She doesn't want to.
It'll fall out. Yeah,
because it falls out.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the idea. The idea is that we can't give her another eye. We just can't get her vision out of that kind of an eye. But what we can do is we can try and support that prosthetic, and that will give her a better look.
A few days later, we're in the operating room. Dr. Bush working on her face. Another surgeon on the bone in her lower leg.
So on track?
Yeah, on track. Okay. So ahead of schedule. We did the trick.
After 14 hours in surgery, Dr. Bush deems the operation a success. But this is only the first of 3 major surgeries she'll need over the next few months. In June, she'll be back in the hospital to have her nose rebuilt, then later her jaw. It's a grueling process. It still hurts to eat. The vision in her remaining eye is poor. She still has nightmares, though fewer than before. But Shakila Zareen is a survivor, in every sense of the word. For The World, I'm Laura Lynch in Vancouver, Canada.
Laura followed Shakila Zareen for nearly a year. You can read the full story and see photos of her remarkable recovery. We have the link on our Facebook page. Just look for PRI The World. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for being with us today.
PRI, Public Radio International.